difficulty, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Julian Wong, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the Saturday/Sunday, May 30th to 31st, 2026 issues of the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Trump aides weigh killing fund. More Republicans push back against the idea of a payout for president's allies. President Trump's top aides have discussed whether he should kill the administration's nearly $1.8 billion anti-weaponization fund in exchange for getting immigration enforcement funding passed next month, according to people familiar with the matter. More than a dozen Republican senators have privately urged top Trump aides to drop the fund since its creation last week, people familiar with the outreach said, including Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, who is usually supportive of the president's efforts. Administration officials have grown increasingly concerned about the viability of the fund, people familiar with the matter said, which had been expected to provide payouts to a swath of Trump allies. Trump hasn't agreed to drop the fund, but has told allies that he understands he has political problems with Senate Republicans. The people said. On Friday, a federal judge ordered a temporary pause on efforts to stand up the fund while she weighs a legal challenge in an Eastern Virginia federal court. Many Senate Republicans pressed Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche on it at a contentious meeting last week that Senator Ted Cruz, Republican from Texas, referred to as one of the roughest in his time in the Senate. Another attendee said it was the most critical grilling of an administration official they had ever seen from Republican senators. The fund was established in exchange for Trump dropping his lawsuit against the Internal Revenue Service and a pair of claims seeking about $230 million over past investigations into him. The president's personal lawyers, including Boris Epstein, were among those involved in discussions about the fund, according to people familiar with the matter. Epstein has suggested potential names to others for the five-member commission set to review claims and provide payouts, the people said. Only a few Justice Department officials were involved in the fund's creation, including Blanche's top aide, Trent McCotter, and the department's Office of Legal Counsel, people familiar with the matter said. Senior Trump aides in the White House learned of the fund a few days before it was announced publicly, people familiar with the timing said. Many lawmakers are worried the fund, set up to pay people who claim political persecution, could mean that rioters who stormed the Capitol and assaulted police on January 6, 2021, could walk away with millions from the federal government if the fund went forward. Blanche has said outrage over the fund is premature, as it is in its early stages. The fund is completely legal, allowed under our laws, and has been done before, he told CNN last week. A White House spokeswoman referred a request for comment to the Justice Department. A Justice Department spokeswoman said Blanche stands by his public defense of the fund and that a separate group at the agency had been documenting what it saw as abuses by the Biden administration well before it was created. It is no secret that many were victims of the weaponization of the past administration, the department spokeswoman said. This type of lawfare should never occur again, under any administration. The president remains angry about being audited by the IRS and about the criminal investigations he faced before returning to the White House, including one that involved the FBI searching his Mar-a-Lago residence. The raid came after Trump took classified documents from the White House and declined to return them. He frequently talks to aides and his lawyers about the audits he faced, and the separate leak of his tax returns, and his desire for revenge, people familiar with the comments said. Blanche and other officials hadn't anticipated the level of backlash the fund has generated among Republican lawmakers, people familiar with the matter said. In his January lawsuit, Trump had sought at least $10 billion in damages from the IRS, which is part of the Treasury Department, for the illegal disclosure, for the illegal disclosure of his tax returns by a government contractor. The agreement creating the fund came just ahead of a deadline for the two sides to address whether they were sufficiently adverse. With Trump on both sides of the lawsuit for the case to exist. U.S. District Judge Kathleen Williams had appointed outside lawyers to address that question and scheduled a hearing for late May. Williams, an Obama appointee to the Federal District Court in South Florida, closed the case after Trump's personal lawyers moved to drop it. On Wednesday, a group of 35 former judges urged her to reopen the case, arguing that the purported sentiment, the purported settlement that the parties never placed before this court raises profound questions about the parties' candor toward the court and the manipulation of the judicial system. Some Trump advisors have privately raised concerns about the agreement dragging down Republicans in the midterms and creating a fund that will be difficult for the party to defend on the campaign trail. The Treasury Department's top lawyer, Brian Morrissey, stepped down the day the fund was announced. Officials debated for months how to handle Trump's lawsuit and had agreed they couldn't pay the president directly given how voters might revolt over such a payout, people familiar with the matter said. They also, at various times, discussed how to compensate people who had claimed they were harmed by the Biden administration, such as anti-abortion protesters who were prosecuted but later pardoned by Trump, and people affected by policies they say were unfair to Christians, the people said. White House officials said the administration could still settle cases without a fund. Americans strained to pay down $1.25 trillion credit card bill. After working all day as an operations director at a busy New England hospital, Catherine Clark would lie awake at night wondering where she went wrong. Despite her $194,000 salary, Clark's Chase Sapphire credit card balance had crept up to $15,000. She could afford the $572 monthly minimum, but with a 26% interest rate, it barely made a dent. Like many Americans, Clark, who is 42 years old, was pushed to her financial limit by the 1-2 punch of inflation and the highest interest rates in decades. She avoided going out with friends to save money and considered taking a second job as a receptionist at her gym. She imagined something terrible befalling her and her parents discovering her mounting credit card bills. It felt very similar to a struggle with weight, Clark said. It doesn't happen overnight. It happens slowly, and then suddenly you're like, oh crap, my pants don't fit. In the first quarter of this year, the percentage of credit card balances that were at least 90 days delinquent rose to 13.12%, according to data released in May by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. That's the highest level in 15 years, and the most since the period following the 2008 financial crisis. America's total credit card balance stood at $1.25 trillion in the first quarter, according to the New York Fed, up from $1.18 trillion in that quarter last year. That's the highest first quarter balance since the New York Fed began recording the measurement in 1999. President Trump has played down economic stress from higher prices. Asked earlier this month whether the financial situation of Americans was a motive to end the Iran war, he said, not even a little bit. Republicans in Congress, though, are facing mounting voter anxiety over the economy ahead of November midterms. Average interest rates on cards rose to 21% in February, from 14.6% in February 2022, according to a survey of credit card issuing banks by the Federal Reserve. Last year, 5.6% of credit card holders were 60 days or more behind on their payments, surpassing pre-pandemic levels, according to data compiled by Brino Braga, an economist with the Urban Institute, a left-of-center research group. Over the past 2 years, his analysis showed the rate rose to its highest level since 2018 for residents of lower, middle, and upper income communities alike. When food, housing, and health care is all more expensive, there is less money to pay off your credit card, Braga said. So more people are faced with decisions. They don't want to lose their house or their cars. They need to pay their utility bills. They're more likely to stop paying their credit cards first. Americans straining to pay off their debt have flooded credit counseling agencies. The National Foundation for Credit Counseling, a network of nonprofits that helps provide people reduce credit card debt, said it had 24% more clients in January than a year earlier. Its average number of monthly clients was 60% higher this year than in 2018. Melissa Megason, a medical assistant from South Portland, Maine, is one of those clients. She always managed to keep her credit card balances near zero. Megason, who earns $65,000, and her then-husband, who made about $70,000 working at a shipyard, used their cards only for gas, groceries, and emergency care for their four dogs, she said. That allowed them to pay down other expenses. $7,000 in back taxes, the remaining bills from her 2016 gastric bypass surgery, and a $1,250 monthly mortgage on their home. When they divorced in 2023, her financial stability was shattered. Alone for the first time in 30 years, she began using credit cards on items to help her cope, such as cooking equipment for a baking hobby and new jeans after she lost weight. She started putting dog food and vet appointments on the cards, too. The interest rate on one reached 29%. Each time she missed the payment, the late fees made it impossible to pay even the minimum. Within 9 months, Megason's credit card balance ballooned to over $20,000. With missed payments and late fees, the minimum on her Capital One card rocketed to $1,600, she said. Collection agencies rang her constantly. They don't let up with the phone calls, she said. I think I was being called every hour at my work at home, but I just didn't have the money. Americans carry, on average, about $6,500 to $6,700 in credit card debt, according to credit reporting agencies. The percentage of cardholders with balances of more than $10,000 has risen in communities across different income levels since 2018. Analysis from the Urban Institute data shows. Last year, 17% of cardholders in low-income communities held balances greater than that amount, 20% in medium-income communities, and 25% in higher-income communities. The National Foundation for Credit Counseling produces a quarterly financial stress forecast that predicts credit card delinquency risk based on client metrics from credit counseling groups. Delinquency risk levels over the past 12 months have been the highest since the forecast's inception in 2022. Middle-class households, in particular, are struggling to pay down balances as more families shift to a pattern of survival debt, said Bruce McClary, spokesman for the foundation. In Megason's case, the incessant bills and collection calls, coupled with the anguish of divorce, were like an ear-splitting noise that she couldn't quiet. One night in August of 2024, she said she tried to kill herself. Terrified, she contacted a friend who called 911. She was hospitalized for a week. When she got out, she sold her house, using the $100,000 net to pay off most of her debts, except the credit cards. American Consumer Credit Counseling, a nonprofit that works with credit card companies to reduce interest rates and monthly payments for people in debt, helped her devise a payback plan. She has since paid off about half of her credit card debt with payments of $586 a month. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Recently remarried, she has sworn off credit cards, though her husband keeps one for emergencies. The couple can narrowly swing their $2,500 rent on a townhouse in South Portland, but are looking to purchase a small house to save money. "I am a little better off, but still living paycheck to paycheck," Megason said. "It's very tempting to open new credit cards to ease that burden. But from my past mistakes, I know it makes things worse in the end." The jump in interest rates is making it especially hard for those on low economic rungs to dig out of debt. Cardholders in low-income communities, zip codes with an average household income less than $89,500, had 60-day delinquencies of 8%, the highest rate of any income level, according to Braca's analysis. Joseph Daniel Host, 46, was working as an executive assistant at an Episcopal church in Grosse Pointe Farms, Michigan, several years ago when the trouble started with his credit cards. Daniel Host, who made $40,000 at the time, relied on his three cards as a way to plug the gap when cash got low toward the end of the church's two-week pay period. Gas and groceries, a new set of sheets at Target, the occasional dinner out with friends. For Daniel Host, a classically trained pipe organist who plays in regional orchestras and teaches piano on the side, his expenditures hardly seemed exorbitant. Besides, he lived rent-free in church housing. He would stagger payments, making headway on one card by paying just over the minimum 1 month, then doing the same on a different card the next. But with interest rates on the cards rising to between 24 and 26%, the balances veered in the wrong direction. "It was a perilous game of juggling," he said. "I could see the debt grow even though I was making payments." A large percentage of people carry persistent balances, said Scott Hsu, an economist at West Virginia University who studies credit card spending. "They are hit hard when interest rates spike, especially if their balances are high," he said. "If you only pay that minimum balance, you may never pay off the credit card debt," said Hsu, who previously worked for the Federal Reserve Board of Governors. Daniel Host and his husband, who was in nursing school, struggled to figure out how to generate more income to pay off car debt that had surged to $20,000. It strained their relationship. Daniel Host drew back from friends, concocting excuses to avoid meals out unless a friend offered to pay. Tension over the cards contributed to Daniel Host and his husband splitting. No matter how many music gigs he took on the side, he couldn't make progress on his balances. A doctor prescribed him antidepressants and anti-anxiety medication, he said. He contemplated suicide. On a whim, he took a job at a local nonprofit that helps low-income people get the proper documentation to apply for federal food and housing assistance. His salary went up by $20,000, then another $30,000 when he was named the group's executive director. He got involved in a new relationship. Still, he secretly carried his debt around like an invisible weight. Sitting on the couch at his new partner's home one night, he unburdened himself. His partner confided that he, too, had about $12,000 of credit card debt and had recently started working with Consolidated Credit, a nonprofit that provides debt management programs to help people pay down their balances. Daniel Host agreed to get in touch. The nonprofit negotiated his card's interest rates down to 6%. And over the past 2 years, Daniel Host has paid off what he owed. The couple, now married, bought a home. They have a $1,900 mortgage and still keep two cards, one for emergencies and one for discretionary expenses, which they try to limit. Catherine Clark also has paid off her debt, at first with the help of a debt counseling program she entered last year, and then with a bonus from work in December. The experience has left her shaken. She has scaled back her gym membership, bought a coffee machine to cut out her daily Starbucks trips, and does everything possible to pay her balance as soon as her paycheck hits her bank account. Like a lot of Americans, she said, I'm one or two big emergencies away from being like, oh God, I'm going to go back into debt. The UN is going broke. US, China get blame. The United Nations is going broke as the United States and China withhold payments in a jostle for control. Washington has failed to pay billions of dollars owed to the institution and exited dozens of its programs and agencies, including the World Health Organization, to combat what President Trump describes as wasteful spending and bad policymaking. The United States is more than $4 billion in arrears to the United Nations. China has compounded the UN's liquidity crisis by slow-walking its own payments. Even as Beijing declares itself the international body's leading defender and, in a jab at the United States, the de facto number one financial contributor. Beijing owes the UN $455 million after it injected almost $850 million this week into the institution during a visit by Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi. The United Nations relies on United States and Chinese money for 42% of its basic funding. Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned that the United Nations is in a race to bankruptcy and cited a very real prospect of the financial collapse of our organization. On the current trajectory, the United Nations said it would be out of cash by mid-August, when the process of picking a successor to Guterres shifts into high gear. China said it would honor its obligations. The United States said it is conditioning future financial support on deeper savings, with more job cuts, less business class travel, and greater use of machine translators. What we are working toward is not a rejection of multilateralism, but putting clarity and results over inefficiency and hollow words. A top State Department official, Michael G. DeSombre, told the United Nations Security Council on Tuesday. The United Nations has complained about funding problems in the past, but this time it is taking unprecedented actions to deal with the shortfall. Starved of cash, the United Nations has made historically large spending cuts and embarked on an efficiency drive. It has closed offices and eliminated a record 3,000 secretariat posts. It has shortened interpreter hours, powered down escalators, and ignored loose cladding on its 75-year-old headquarters. The United Nations has accelerated troop drawdowns in African hotspots such as the Democratic Republic of the Congo and slashed peacekeeping expenditures. It has also delayed reimbursements to Nepal, Bangladesh, and other poor nations that supply troops for Blue Helmet operations. How insolvency would play out for the world's leading international forum is unclear. But staff around the world would go unpaid, halting food and security programs. The United Nations can't borrow money, and its leadership has limited power to restructure operations or fire employees, whose salaries account for 70% of expenses. The United Nations 193 member states determine staffing and mandates, and they have been more inclined to add initiatives than cut the body's roughly 40,000 programs. When the United Nations comptroller tried to save 700,000 by closing one of the headquarters' secure entrances, diplomats revolted at the inconvenience of a crisis largely manufactured in Washington. The gate reopened 2 days later. The United Nations sprawl includes the New York-based Secretariat and 15 specialized agencies such as the World Health Organization and the International Civil Aviation Organization, which respectively coordinate responses to diseases like Ebola and ensure aircraft fly safely. It also manages more than 50,000 peacekeepers in conflict zones. The funding deficit hits the United Nations as it is saddled with ever more governance challenges, from artificial intelligence and biosecurity to ocean mining in outer space. The United States and China are both permanent members of the United Nations Security Council, where most nations get rotating seats but no veto. United Nations finances are Byzantine. The organization runs different budgets for its regular operations and its more costly peacekeeping endeavors. The specialized agencies handle their own money and bureaucracies. Assessments are based on the size of member economies, with United States contributions capped at 22% of the regular budget. China's economic growth in the past decade has pushed it to second place. Unusual rules undermine the United Nations' financial position. Funds unspent at year-end get credited back to member states based on what nations owe, whether or not they contributed. Chronically late payments limit the time for the United Nations to allocate the funds. We are trapped in a Kafkaesque cycle, expected to give back cash that does not exist, the Secretary General wrote to members this year, urging them to adjust the policy. In line with its large cutbacks in foreign assistance, including the closing of the United States Agency for International Development, the Trump administration has overhauled how it will provide voluntary assistance at the United Nations. At the United Nations, the Trump administration has begun to channel aid money through a single department established to manage emergencies, the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, earmarking $3.8 billion so far. The United States remains the largest underwriter and humanitarian funding, but its allocation is down from more than $10 billion or more annually in recent years. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. A Russian drone crashes in Romania, fuels NATO tensions. A Russian drone crashed into an apartment building Friday in NATO member Romania, raising tensions with the alliance and stoking fears that Russia will attempt to expand its war beyond Ukraine. Romania scrambled jet fighters in an attempt to intercept the drone after it crossed the border from Ukraine into the southeastern city of Galați, where it set the roof of the apartment building on fire and injured several people, authorities said. The drone incursion raised alarms among North Atlantic Treaty Organization allies and fed European fears that Russia is working to escalate its confrontation with the alliance over its aid to Ukraine as Moscow struggles in the battlefield. Russia's reckless behavior is a danger to us all, said NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte. They continue to target civilians and civilian infrastructure across Ukraine, and last night showed yet again that the implications of their illegal war of aggression do not stop at the border. The country has been a stalwart U.S. ally, and earlier this year approved a request from the United States to allow the deployment of refueling planes, as well as surveillance and satellite communications equipment, on the country's bases to support the war against Iran. We stand with our NATO ally Romania and condemn this reckless incursion on its territory, said the United States Ambassador to NATO, Matthew Whitaker. Kaja Kallas, the European Union's top diplomat, said the incident represented a blatant and serious violation of Romania's sovereignty and European airspace. President Vladimir Putin of Russia questioned whether the drone was Russian and called on Romania to hand over the wreckage so that Russia could conduct its own investigation. No one can say the origin of this or that aircraft until an examination of that aircraft is conducted, he said. Last week, suspected Russian drones approached Lithuania from Belarus, triggering air raid alarms and sending the government into a bunker. Russia also recently threatened to bomb Latvia over accusations that it was hosting Ukrainian drone operators that were striking Russian targets, a claim Latvia denied. On Friday, Putin reiterated his claims against Latvia. He said Russia didn't want conflict with the West, but added that Moscow would counter direct military threats. Anywhere that presents a threat, I want to underscore, a direct military threat to Russia is a legal target, he said. It was unclear whether the drone was intentionally sent across the border. Romania has repeatedly reported Russian drones entering its airspace, and some have previously crashed in remote areas. Full responsibility lies with the Russian Federation, whose behavior demonstrates total disregard for international law and for the safety of the citizens of a NATO member state, President Nicușor Dan of Romania wrote in a post on X. The drone incursions have highlighted the vulnerability of Europe's air defense systems against drones, which have become a fixture of the war in Ukraine. Last year, Western officials said a swarm of Russian drones that entered Poland's airspace appeared to be an attempt to test the country's defense systems, as well as NATO's response. After that, NATO allies donated aircraft and air defense systems to bolster its eastern flank. There are fears in Europe that Russia could do something to spark greater confrontation with NATO, as its war effort in Ukraine falters. Russia is struggling to recruit soldiers to replace the tens of thousands of troops it loses each month on the battlefield, while its economy continues to show the strain of more than 4 years of war despite. Russia could use tensions with NATO to get allies to hold back military supplies from Ukraine and provide a basis for a renewed military mobilization at home, Russian and European analysts said. Russia's efforts to destabilize the West and undermine NATO are linked to its growing hardships on the front line, said John Foreman, a former United Kingdom's defense attaché to Moscow and Kiev. It can't compete on a level playing field, said Foreman, who added that Russia seeks to undermine European democracy and sow discord. The tools change, but the intent remains the same. Romania hosts around 1,000 U.S. soldiers, primarily on two bases, including the Deveselu military base that maintains the United States Navy's Aegis Ashore missile defense system, part of NATO's ballistic missile defense network. Romanian Brigadier General George Maxim said the military can't shoot over Ukrainian territory, and had only had 4 minutes between the moment when the drone crossed into the country's airspace and when it crashed into the apartment's block. Dan, the Romanian president, said that the country had informed all of its NATO allies and EU partners. He said Romania had requested additional anti-drone capabilities from its allies and had alerted the United Nations Security Council. Following an emergency defense council meeting, he said Romania would close a Russian consulate in Constanta and expel its consul general. Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman, Maria Zakharova, said Moscow would respond in turn. Foreign Minister Andriy Sybiha of Ukraine said that incursion into Romanian airspace proved the threat that Russia poses to the Black Sea region and Europe as a whole, and echoed entreaties to allies to boost aid to Ukraine, in particular, air defense. Ukraine is facing a shortage of air defense munitions, while much of the United States supplies have recently gone to allies in the Middle East. The United States said last year that it would rotate the 2nd Infantry Brigade combat team of the 101st Airborne Division out of Romania, in one of the Trump administration's first steps to reduce its military footprint in Europe. The Pentagon said, at the time, that the move didn't represent a lessening of its commitment to NATO. The House asks Bondi about Epstein. Democrats say ex-attorney general wouldn't answer queries about Trump. Democratic lawmakers said former Attorney General Pam Bondi refused to answer questions about President Trump during a closed-door interview with the House Oversight Committee over the Justice Department's handling of materials from the Jeffrey Epstein investigation. She said she would not speak or respond to any questions that had anything to do with President Trump. Representative Robert Garcia of California, the committee's ranking Democrat, said Friday. Democratic committee members said Bondi at first refused to answer questions about private conversations with Trump and then wouldn't respond to any involving the president. Bondi's appearance marks the 13th interview in the House Oversight Committee's investigation of Epstein, the convicted sex offender. During her year-long tenure, Bondi, who stepped down in April, faced criticism over the department's handling of disclosures related to its investigation into Epstein. From those who accused officials of stonewalling efforts to shed more light on the investigation, and from Trump and his allies who believed she mismanaged it. In her opening remarks Friday, Bondi told the committee she delegated most responsibility for managing the release to Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche, then the department's number two official. She said that as far as she knew, the department had released everything required under the law, although she acknowledged some redaction errors. Democratic lawmakers said she referred further questions on the issues to Blanche or FBI Director Kash Patel. Bondi said later Friday on social media that she had praised Blanche over his management of this Herculean task. The Justice Department has released millions of documents related to its Epstein investigation, as required under the Epstein Files Transparency Act. That law, passed by Congress last year over the objections of Trump, is meant to bring more transparency to the investigation into Epstein, who socialized with Trump years before he was president, among other powerful figures in politics, business, and academia. The department has come under fire for its handling of the process, including failing to initially redact the names of dozens of victims and not initially releasing some FBI documents that referenced allegations against Trump. Officials have said they complied with the law and addressed any errors when notified, and that redaction errors were limited. "I want every document," James Comer, the House Oversight Committee's Republican chairman, said before Bondi's interview. Democratic lawmakers on the committee walked out of a closed-door briefing with Bondi in March, saying they didn't trust her to answer their questions unless she was under oath. On Friday, Democratic lawmakers said the only Republican congressman in the room was Comer, as Congress is on recess. Several Republicans had joined Democrats on the committee in March in voting to sub Buena Bondi, saying they still had questions only she could answer. Bondi appeared voluntarily for Friday's interview. One of the GOP committee members who has been most supportive of the Epstein investigation, Representative Nancy Mace, was absent on Friday, with a spokesman saying it was because of the June 9th South Carolina gubernatorial primary, in which she is a candidate. A transcript of Friday's interview, which wasn't conducted under oath, is expected to be released after review by the Justice Department's Harmeet Dhillon, Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights at the Justice Department, also appeared alongside Bondi, representing the department. Democratic lawmakers said Dhillon stepped in to stop Bondi from answering some questions on Friday, at some points covering her microphone and directing her not to respond. Just as President Trump has said, he's been totally exonerated on anything related to Epstein, Abigail Jackson, White House spokeswoman, said Friday. The Justice Department didn't respond to a request for comment. Representative Yasemin Ansari, Democrat from Arizona, called the session on Friday morning a ridiculous charade. "She is supposed to be here under oath today, on video answering questions about her role and the direct hand she had in this cover-up," Ansari said. "Instead, she is deflecting, She is refusing to answer questions, and she continues to refuse to answer specific questions about the President of the United States. Trump said he cut off ties with Epstein long before Epstein was first arrested in 2006. Epstein pleaded guilty in Florida State Court to soliciting a minor for prostitution in 2008. Federal prosecutors in 2019 charged Epstein with sex trafficking underage girls in Florida and New York. He died in jail while awaiting trial, and his death was ruled a suicide. Garcia said before Friday's hearing that he and other Democrats continue to be incredibly disappointed to not have this interview videotaped and then released to the American public. Videos of other Epstein-related interviews with the committee have been publicly released. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. China threatens EU with trade probes. Beijing threatened to launch trade probes against the European Union if the 27-member bloc pushes ahead with a proposal to curb imports of heavily subsidized foreign products. Chinese authorities could initiate anti-discrimination and supply chain security investigations into the European Union's overcapacity instrument, a social media account run by China's state broadcaster said Friday, citing unnamed sources. If the EU advances the tool, China will take immediate action and deploy countermeasures, it added. The heated rhetoric came ahead of European officials meeting for closely watched talks on Friday to discuss ramping up the bloc's trade defenses, a move widely seen as aimed at shielding critical industries from Chinese rivals. European leaders say China's global industrial dominance is a result of decades of government subsidies and non-reciprocal market access. In a joint paper seen by Dow Jones Newswires foreshadowing the talks, five European Union member states, including France, Spain, and the Netherlands, called for the bloc's executive arm to launch more probes into potentially unfair trading practices, be proactive when disputing alleged breaches at the World Trade Organization, amend existing rules to prevent businesses from circumventing them, and allocate more resources to its trade policy unit to tackle the surge in investigations into dumping and subsidies. The European Union's industry chief, Stephanie Séjourné, also told the Financial Times and other media outlets this past week that Brussels would broaden the use of its trade defenses, such as import quotas and tariffs, in a bid to shield European industries such as chemicals and clean technology from state-backed Chinese competitors. After the Commission's debate on Friday ended, the European Union executive issued a statement saying trade and investment relations with Beijing are not sustainable. China is a critical partner, and engagement and dialogue will continue. At the same time, the current state of the trade and investment relationship is not sustainable, the Commission said. As economic and security interests become ever more intertwined, both dimensions will require a more robust and coherent response, it added, that the Friday discussions would feed into work in the coming weeks, ahead of a G7 meeting and a European Council summit in June. Analysts say new safeguards could effectively serve as a new trade defense mechanism against China, though policy measures are still under debate among European Union states. By empowering Brussels to cap imports and impose sector-wide tariffs, the tool would target Chinese industrial exports in key markets, like electric vehicles, steel, and solar panels, according to analysts. Yuyuan Tanqian, the state-run social media account, said the measure is specifically aimed at China, even though the European Union hasn't explicitly stated that. The European Union's economic and trade policy toward China is going further and further down a radical path, it said, citing several European Union moves this year, including the Industrial Accelerator Act, aimed at bolstering the bloc's industrial capacity. Canada's economy shrinks for second straight quarter. Ottawa. Canada's economy unexpectedly contracted for a second consecutive quarter, as activity stalled at the start of the year, raising the likelihood the country dipped into a recession. Gross domestic product, a broad measure of goods and services produced across Canada, edged down 0.1% in seasonally adjusted annualized terms in the January to March period, Statistics Canada said Friday. The economy also contracted a larger than previously estimated 1% in the final quarter of last year. Back-to-back quarterly declines typically define a technical recession. The CD Howe think tank's Business Cycle Council is the closest Canada has to an official arbiter on declaring a recession, though economists suggest the pullback could prove fleeting because of government stimulus and a tailwind for energy exports from high oil prices. The country's economy has struggled to gain momentum since the Trump administration began imposing tariffs as the resulting uncertainty hit manufacturers in Canada hard. The economy has contracted in three of the last five quarters. The last time Canada's economy compressed in consecutive quarters, outside of the first year of the COVID-19 pandemic, was early in 2015, when oil prices slumped. The weakness in the first quarter reflected a jump in volatile gold imports, ongoing weakness in business investment, and a pullback in government spending on weapons systems after big outlays at the end of 2025. Balancing that, household spending remained positive, and business inventories were built back up after big withdrawals in the prior quarter. Meanwhile, Canada's population fell for a second quarter running, softening overall demand but spelling growth for the economy in per capita terms. While the decline in GDP in the latest quarter was muted, it jars against expectations the economy recovered. Economists and the central bank anticipated annualized growth of about 1.5%. The Bank of Canada had projected growth would average about 1.2% in 2026, accelerating to 1.6% the following year with a gradual rise in exports and business investment and as slack in the economy is taken up. While there will be plenty of debate over whether this constitutes a recession, we would say no, not really. There is little debate that the economy has struggled to make any headway over the past year amid the continuing trade conflict, said Douglas Porter, chief economist at Bank of Montreal Capital Markets. Porter said that even if it is a recession only in name, the latest data should dampen any speculation the Bank of Canada will lift interest rates this year after remaining on hold at its last four policy meetings. Final domestic demand, a gauge of spending by all sectors of the economy and a measure of the health of the economy, fell 0.1% from the prior quarter after expanding 0.7% in the fourth quarter of 2025. Consumer consumption remained resilient, with household spending up 0.4% from the quarter before, thanks to increased outlays on food and financial services. Consumption was tempered by fewer Canadians traveling abroad and a decline in purchases of new vehicles. Replimune to resubmit cancer drug for FDA approval. Replimune Group said Friday it has reached an agreement with the Food and Drug Administration on a path to resubmit its application for its experimental treatment for advanced melanoma. It wasn't clear whether Replimune would submit new clinical data or additional analyses of existing trial results to help secure approval. The company plans to resubmit the application in coming days, the company said. Replimune shares closed up about 86% in Friday trading. The move marks a reversal for a drug that became one of the most contentious rejections for the agency under the leadership of former FDA Commissioner Marty Makary, and illustrates how quickly priorities are shifting in the agency in the wake of the commissioner's departure earlier this month. The FDA twice rejected Replimune's application for approval, first in July of 2025 and in April, saying the data from a single-arm trial in which all patients received the experimental drug with no comparison group fell short of proving to the agency that the treatment worked. The agency also said the mix of patients enrolled made the results hard to interpret. About a third of patients with treatment-resistant melanoma saw their tumors shrink after taking Replimune's drug combined with a second cancer drug, Bristol-Myers Squibb's Opdivo. Replimune had accused the FDA of being inconsistent in prior rejections of its drugs with different teams reviewing its drug each time. While still ahead of the agency, Makary publicly defended rejecting Replimune's drug. "If your drug works, it's going to get approved," he said, in an interview with CNBC. More than 110,000 people in the United States are expected to be diagnosed with melanoma this year, the National Cancer Institute estimates, and more than 8,000 people with advanced disease are expected to die nationwide. The FDA's reversal comes less than 3 weeks after Makary's resignation. Kyle Diamantis, a lawyer who is overseeing food regulation at the agency, has since been named acting commissioner. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the Saturday/Sunday, May 30th to 31st, 2026 issues of the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition. We read from the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition every Monday at 7 a.m. Your reader has been Julian Wong. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Volunteer radio readers broadcast daily readings 24 hours a day of newspapers, magazines, books, and other printed matter to area people who are blind or have a print disability, who are provided reading radios. The Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service has broadcast almost 40 years of radio readings to those without sight. Our broadcast signal is provided at no charge by WNED. Radio Reading Studios are at 1199 Harlem Road in Cheektowaga. For more information on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, call 716-821-5555. following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability, which makes